He kōna I purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Kia ora, my name's Corin Dan and welcome to this morning's episode of Morning Report Essentials, the podcast, of course, which gives you everything you need from Morning Report. Now, we had a very interesting Monday morning. Water was the dominant theme this morning, Ingrid, wasn't it? With a number of interviews around this Water Done Well, which is the replacement for Three Waters. So we heard from both government and Labor this morning.
We had to resuscitate the term balance sheet separation, which I was kind of hoping we wouldn't have to talk about again. But we did give a thorough explanation of Auckland's deal and what it might mean for the rest of the country as well. And then from one extreme to the other, we also had an interview about a song about farts.
This is great.
Yeah, everything covered. You were quite a fan, Corin.
Well, Tammy Nielsen singing a song written by the Front Lawn duo of Dom DeGlashan and Harry Sinclair. What more could you ask for?
Well, the pedigree was there, but we will leave it up to you to decide to enjoy the episode. Auckland Council is retaining control of its water services in a new deal signed off with the government. Councillors voted unanimously in support of the plan, which will separate council finances from water care. The question remains about how smaller regions will fare as negotiations with the government continue. Local Government Minister Simeon Brown joins me now in our Auckland studio. Kia ora, good morning.
Good morning.
Right, so you have achieved the hallowed balance sheet separation for Auckland, which basically means water care can now borrow more to pay for pipes.
That is correct. So this ultimately means that Auckland Council and water care will be financially separate. We keep water rates down. We avoid the 25.8% water rate increase on 1 July. And we also, really importantly, allow water care to be able to invest in the critical water infrastructure that Auckland needs to clean up our harbour, to invest in the water pipes needed to unlock housing growth, and to be able to make sure we've got healthy drinking water here in Auckland.
Okay, just looking at those savings, because 7%, the increase which is now going to happen, does look good compared to the 26-odd% which may have happened. Labor, though, says it would have only been 2% under Three Waters.
Well, that's a figure that they put together when they were trying to desperately sell their Three Waters program prior to the election. That was based on a price cap. It wasn't based on what Entity A was projecting the price to be on 1 July. And so effectively...
What was that then?
Well, it was a lot more than 7%. It was more likely to be somewhere between 14 and 25%. But ultimately, Entity A still hadn't been set up. And in fact, the first thing I received on becoming the Minister of Local Government was that Entity A was unlikely to be able to be set up by 1st of July, meaning Aucklanders would have faced that 25.8% water rate increase if Labor had been re-elected. So we've been able to...
Entity A being separated,
for Auckland. Yeah. So ultimately, they can talk numbers, but that price cap would have meant that water care would not have been able to invest in that capital program. So if there was a 2% price cap, they would have had to cut capital expenditure in Auckland, and Labor would have to say, well, what projects would they be happy with not going ahead in our biggest city?
So there may have been a 2%.
Well, it was based on a price cap. And if you put a price cap in place, you've got to ultimately reduce investment. And this deal that we've struck with Auckland means that the financial separation occurs, the continued pipeline of investment takes place in Auckland, such as the water, the Central Interceptor project, which is a critical part of making sure we've got clean water in Auckland. That continues.
Sure.
And we also keep those costs down for Aucklanders
water
during the cost of living crisis.
We'll still borrow that. They'll borrow more money, and eventually water users will have to pay for it. It's just over a longer term.
Well, it's like paying for a mortgage. Ultimately, you spread the cost over a long period of time. These are 100-year assets, and the people who benefit from them are not just people today, but people in many, many years from now. And so by being able to borrow more, they're able to spread that cost over a longer period of time, and the people who benefit from it will pay for that infrastructure.
What about other parts of the country, smaller councils in less financial, in more financial hardship? What about them? Because you did start with the easy one.
Well, Auckland, I mean, if it was easy, why did the last government not do something in the last 6 years? They spent $1.2 billion and failed to actually sort out this problem. So we spent $350,000 with S&P. We came up with a solution, and now we're implementing
it. So what about the rest of the country?
We're working on legislation which will come to Parliament in the middle of this year, which will provide for councils to be able to set up regional CCOs, joint CCOs.
That's the tricky part, isn't it?
And so the legislation will help enable that. The other part about it is making sure they've got the funding and financing tools. So whether it's a community trust, whether it's a regional CCO, whether it's a council wanting to just simply ring fence its revenues to be able to invest it, we're going to have a range of options for councils to be able to make that financially sustainable approach to water in their local community. That's what Local Water Done Well is all about.
That regional cooperation part of it, though, was the tricky part. That was what Auckland didn't want any part of. So how do you make that happen in other parts
of the country? Well, we're going to require all councils to put forward their plans for a financially sustainable approach to water infrastructure in their community. So they'll have 12 months to do that from the passing of that legislation. They'll have to put forward how they're going to work together with other councils. I know that there's many councils across New Zealand are already having those conversations. In Wellington, they're already talking about how they can create a financially sustainable CCO for the Wellington region. I know that these conversations, I was in the Bay of Plenty on Friday, the conversations are happening there too. So local communities will be leading those conversations rather than the government coming along and mandating co-governed mega entities on local communities, which ultimately were rejected by voters at the last election.
Appreciate your time this morning. That was Local Government Minister Simeon Brown.
Now, the Labor Party is crying foul over Auckland's new water plan, which separates council finances from Watercare, saying its plan would have been more affordable. The replacement for Three Waters, called Local Water Done Well, brings a projected water rates rise of 25.8% down to 7.2%. Local Government Minister Simeon Brown told Morning Report earlier, this is a better deal than Aucklanders would have seen under Labor's mega entities.
It was a lot more than 7%. It was more likely to be somewhere between 14 and 25%. But ultimately, Entity A still hadn't been set up. And in fact, the first thing I received on becoming the Minister of Local Government was that Entity A was unlikely to be able to be set up by 1st of July, meaning Aucklanders would have faced that 25.8% water rate increase if Labor had been re-elected.
Well, Labor's local government spokesperson, Kieran McAnulty, joins us now. Kia ora, good morning.
Kia ora.
Your response to that, so Simeon Brown arguing there that Aucklanders would have got hit with that upfront cost because your Three Waters plan wouldn't have been ready.
Well, I'm pretty suspicious about that. We've already seen track record of this government claiming they've received advice to suit their narrative. I'll give you an example. The Prime Minister claimed that they received advice that Kāinga Ora will have to sell 10,000 houses. That was pretty shocking to everybody. But once we dove deeper into that, it turns out that was on the basis of the government not providing funding post-2025. So there's some important context here, and I don't agree with that at all. It is counter to all the advice that I received when I was minister leading right up to the election, that the Entity A would have had a higher credit rating than what is proposed yesterday, AA versus BBB. That in itself is millions of dollars difference when servicing debt between the years. I don't think that stacks up at all. The 26% fee increase that Aucklanders were facing, just like many of the rates increases that the rest of the country are facing, is a direct result of the government scrapping the water reform program, which has proved that it will save ratepayers' money. So, no, I don't accept that.
OK. In the Auckland instance, this is what they wanted, and they've wanted for a very long time, though. They didn't necessarily, well, many didn't necessarily want the wider entity taking on board those other councils. They wanted to deal with it themselves, and they've got what they wanted, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. It's going to cost ratepayers more, but this is what the council wanted. My beef isn't with the mayor. He's doing his job. He's representing his council. But the Minister of Local Government is responsible for all councils. And this model that was announced yesterday simply will not work anywhere else. They don't have the scale. And if they continue down the voluntary route, there will be councils that are left out in the cold because they have a small rate of paying base with massive costs. And who in their right mind would voluntarily join up with them? And so I'm worried about places like Northland, Gisborne, West Coast, and small rural councils like the Tararua District, who simply cannot do it by themselves, but that's exactly where they'll find themselves if the government continues down the route they've signalled.
Well, the government is going to come up with solutions for them, presumably, on an individual basis, if they can't.
They've also gone around the country telling councils that they would help them pay for it, and as soon as they were elected, they've reneged on that promise. And many of the councils indicated support for what National were doing solely on the basis that National promised to help them pay for it. They've reneged on that promise. And in the absence of Crown funding, I can't see any way forward for those smaller councils.
The issue here seems to be that obviously Three Waters was a very divisive policy, drew a lot of controversy, that National was very upfront about the fact that it was going to get rid of it. They've just gone on and done it. I mean, they've moved. They're doing this. It's happening. I mean, should they not get credit for the fact that they've been able to do this without a massive bureaucracy?
Well, there's a lot of talk about the $1.2 billion that was spent to set this up. We're talking about expenditure of $185 billion, and we found a way that was going to allow ratepayers to actually afford that cost. Now there's going to be massive cost discrepancies across the country. Auckland was the easy one. They're the one with scale. They already had water care. There was no question that an Auckland-only deal could be done. But when you're looking at the whole country, actually finding a way that works for everybody so that every ratepayer is paying more or less there or thereabouts a similar amount, you would have to find a different way. So the government have gone ahead and found an Auckland-specific solution that raises even larger questions as to how we're going to go about it across the country. So my concern, as a former Minister of Local Government and now Local Government spokesperson for the opposition, is the whole country, not just the easy ones to pick off at the start.
OK. Do you have any concerns around governance and the ability for Auckland Council and, by extension, other councils to get the right oversight of how these water entities will operate if there is that balance sheet separation under this model?
My concern right from when I took over and then remodelled the water reforms was rates. I have no concerns around the governance, although there are questions now around what this government has set up in that, with the Deputy Mayor saying that the Crown and Council won't be able to step in. What happens if it falls over?
Then what does happen?
To debtors? Well, that's a very good question. If there are debtors owed to an entity that falls over, presumably, plays out that the government can't step in due to this legislation, then they have a relationship to debtors that they will have to settle. And that's a big worry, and the minister needs to settle that one pretty quick, because we fought really hard to ensure that those remain in public hands, and that's such the government's narrative. If through the back door there's a slight possibility of privatisation, they need to clear that up.
Well, there's been reports on this issue yesterday. I think it's interest.co.nz was running this issue. They've clarified that the government could step in if it had to, if it really wanted to, but it's not obliged to. So there's sort of an implicit guarantee there, isn't there?
Well, if that guarantee is going to be applied to every council set up moving forward, that's a massive potential liability for the government, which would not have been in place under the water reforms.
Right, so you're saying that they need to clarify once and for all here, would they step in if... I mean, the other thing is, of course, you heard Desley Simpson, she was arguing that there are a number of checks and balances. Were you happy with that level of checks and balances to ensure that they never got to the point of getting into trouble, not being able to pay their debts?
Yeah, I am reasonably comfortable with what they have put in place. My concern, though, is that what they've put in place is going to cost more than what the water reforms would have. And it's also not a blueprint for the rest of the country. There are genuine questions being posed by media that the government should sort out pretty quick. I don't have the information to suggest whether that's correct or not. And they can do that pretty quick. I think they should, because we need to be having a discussion about rates and about cost. And the 26% fee increase that Aucklanders were facing was a direct result of what the government did in repealing water reform. And they stand up there yesterday and say, we've saved Aucklanders from that fee. They've saved Aucklanders from their own mistake, but other councils don't have that luxury, and the longer they take, the higher the cost will be.
OK, thank you very much for your time, Kieran McInulty, Labor's local government spokesperson.
Well, a new scanner on wheels is promising to bring cutting-edge cancer diagnostics to rural communities. The $7 million mobile unit made in the Netherlands will park at provincial and rural hospitals, making it easier for people to get screened. Mercy Radiology is one of the developers and says tackling the inequity of access to scans was long overdue. Its medical director, Dr. Remy Lim, joins us now. Kia ora, good morning.
Good morning.
Scanner on wheels kind of undersells it, doesn't it? This is some pretty high-tech equipment that you are getting out there. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it really is. This equipment is actually two scanners in one. It's a PET scanner as well as a CT scanner. So the PET camera itself, we get a lot of information regarding cancer activity in the patient, and the CT scan gives us the anatomic localization of where the disease sites are. So it's a really important scan for a lot of, cancer patients. It's standard care. And we want patients who live in the region to be able to access this high-tech imaging as well as they can at metropolitan centres. That's the whole concept of just breaking down barriers to accessing the scan for patients in the rural communities.
Yeah, these scanners are currently permanently in Auckland, Hamilton, Wellington and Christchurch. So who will get access to this particular one?
That's right. So, you know, patients live in Rotorua, for example, they have to travel to Hamilton or Auckland to get a scan, and that often means taking a whole day out of their work and having a support person potentially drive them up there. And remember, these patients have had cancer diagnosis or are dealing with cancer treatment, and it's a stressful time for them. So currently we want to take a scanner to the smaller centres like Rotorua, Taupo, potentially Taranaki, and also Hawke's Bay. So that's where we're targeting right now. And the route is still to be worked out, but that's kind of where we plan to tap the mobile PET CT.
Is this for the public patients?
Absolutely. We want to offer the scan to everyone, public or private. We'd love to have public hospital patients be scanned at the doorstep, basically, rather than having to spend the whole day travelling up to the major centres for the scan.
So how is it being funded?
So just like any other PET CT scans in this country, it's all outsourced. So there are over 40 indications that are currently funded by Te Whatu Ora for a PET CT. It's the same mechanism, really. No different to these patients from, you know, Hastings going up to Auckland for their scan and being funded by the hospital.
Okay, and when will it be on the road?
Well, actually, we're about to scan our first patient in Rotorua in 2 weeks' time. So we'll kick off 2 weeks' time, basically.
Great. Okay, well, thank you very much for that. That was Dr. Remy Lim, a medical director at Mercy Radiology. They've got a new scanner, CT and PET scanner, which will be going around some of the regions in the upper North Island by the sound of things.
Why not have a song about flatulence? Because that has indeed taken out the prize for Best Children's Music Video at the Children's Music Awards.
Good. This feeling inside, it's a powerful thing. You gotta let it out, don't keep it in. You gotta let it out. You gotta let it out. Let me hear your shout. You got to let it out.
Yes, that puts a smile on the face, doesn't it? The song is called Let It Out by Don McGlashan and Harry Sinclair. Features Tammy Nelson. The vocals, it appears on their hit Christchurch-made TV series, Kerry and Lou. Now, I spoke to Don McGlashan earlier and he told me the song, well, it's a little bit more than it seems.
It's actually a subtle and multi-layered piece of art, urging kids not to bottle up their emotions. But admittedly, you know, it's got a bunch of rude noises in the rhythm track.
You must have had a bit of fun coming up with that track then.
Yeah, we did. We've got a team of amazing sound designers. Now, they had all these amazing sort of farty noises, but they ended up, evidently I did the best ones, so I'm quite proud of that.
How did you keep a straight face?
Well, I didn't. And the coolest thing was we got Tammy Nielsen to be the guest artist on it. The Kerry and Lou had already been going for about three seasons. We're into our fourth season now, and she had just written to us saying, if you could find a song for me to guest on, it'll earn me a lot of points with my two young kids.
Do you enjoy writing children's music?
We've been really lucky with Kerry and Lou because we've had no interference. There's no child psychologists or educationalists looking over our shoulder at any point. So it's not, we don't really think we're writing anything for children. We are rather childlike adults, and we're just writing what we like.
And I think I've heard Harry talk about this, the show, it does focus on emotions, right? And dealing with, you know, things that kids have to come across and try and deal with.
Yeah, well, right from the get-go, we thought it would be cool to make something which was a space where kids could kind of sort of learn about their emotions and talk about all the different emotional landscape that you have to deal with when you're a kid. And it sort of does, it's just different from other kids' shows, which tend to be quite violent and action-driven. So, yeah, it's it's a different kind of space for the kid to inhabit.
And do you think it might have a little bit of appeal for adults too? I mean, do you think Tammy will be putting it into one of her shows?
We get a lot of adults telling us it's their favourite show, so that's great.
I mean, is it something that the show, there's a lot of music in there, obviously, I mean, and a lot of stars. Have you considered a live show?
We did, and it's still sort of on the back burner. We just finished a fourth series, and some of those episodes are going to drop on TVNZ Plus next month. But the next thing that we're working on is a sort of a mini feature, like a 60-minute, it's like a prequel. It's like how Kitty and Lou met, and that Harry and I have just been in LA together working on that, on some songs for that. So that's going to keep us busy for the next year and a half or so.
The show itself has been very successful in many countries. I mean, at the Children's Music Video Awards, who are you up against?
I'm not sure who we're up against, but there's a great... I mean, there's always a lot of fantastic people working in that space in New Zealand. It's something that we do really, really well. So it's really, you know, it's a privilege to be in that group, and it's obviously a privilege to win. I know that, you know, overseas we've had some great, really good fortune. We were nominated for a BAFTA in 2022 for this show, so, and we're up against Bluey and a couple of Netflix shows. So given that this is pretty seat of the pants in terms of its resourcing, we're really lucky.
And that is Don McGlashan. I think we buried our lead there, Ingrid. That's a great story, isn't it? Song about farting.
Unless if you're driving the kids to school at the moment, you've got that going. I don't know, might just get on your wicket just a tiny little bit. OK, let's cross now to Canberra and speak with Kerri-Ann Walsh. Kia ora, Kerri-Ann.
Yes, good morning, Ingrid.
Now, another teenager has been shot dead by police over there in Perth, which they're saying has the hallmarks of a terrorism event.
Yes, they haven't quite, the police haven't designated it a terrorism event. They're not quite as quick off the mark as New South Wales was when there was an incident also involving a teenager at a church in Sydney a couple of weeks ago. And the police commissioner there, Karen Webb, is under a lot of pressure over that quick designation of it being a religiously motivated terrorism event. So in Perth, the authorities have held back. They're not prepared to say that until such time as they have more information. But this young lad had been in a de-radicalisation program since he was 2014. This is the tender age between 14 and 19 when we're seeing Australian youth who are particularly vulnerable to online radicalisation, and there's a lot of it going on. It's something that was referred to by our ASIO chief, our spook chief, Mike Burgess, in an address about two or three weeks ago to the National Press Club, that the rising level of vulnerable youth that are being targeted by online radicals is a serious problem for Australia and one that we are late to the party in terms of tackling. So the number of these de-radicalisation programs are slim. And this is something that Anne R. Lee, an MP, a federal MP, and a counter-terrorism and de-radicalisation expert, has been pressing since she's been in Parliament for half a dozen years, which is that we need to take this seriously. It's a growing problem and a threat to Australian society. And she's so far been a voice in the wilderness. But the state of these sorts of attacks in the last month and the arrests in Sydney, which now amount to 8, suggests that this is something that we now have to start looking at seriously for our young men.
That is a worry, yes. Now, your governments, you've got a budget next week, and there are going to be some measures in there to alleviate youth and student poverty. What might they be?
Well, there'll be a number of things. There'll be two main ones. The skyrocketing level of HECS debts, student debts, is something that is really besetting and snookering our young people who choose tertiary education. So many of them face debts for the rest of their lives, basically, to pay the Commonwealth back. And it's been pegged to the Consumer Price Index, or rather inflation, but now it's going to be pegged if it's the lower to the wages price index, which means, for say, for instance, last year when inflation hit 7%, but the wages growth was only 3.5%. So their debt level would only have increased by 3.5%. So that's a measure. It's a small one, but it's a measure that they believe will make a difference. The other one is that those who are undertaking frontline studies, for instance, nursing, midwifery, they will have a payment, a living payment made to them when they're doing their practical blocks. So for some of those, there's been what's known as prac poverty, because when they go on placements, they're not paid. And the placements can be last for up to 3 months. So now they're going to be paid a living wage, and that is going to be a significant factor in encouraging other young people into those disciplines.
Will be interesting to see the details on those policies. Thank you very much. That is Kerry Ann Walsh.
And that's today's Morning Report podcast.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Do tune in tomorrow wherever you get your podcasts from.
The Glossy Ibis. RNZ National.